Not had enough of me yet? Well, good news. You can now listen to William Hill's Upfront with Simon Jordan podcast right here. The series, hosted by me, gives you a front row seat to big name interviews discussing their career successes and failures. Sit back and enjoy.
All supporters want to see players wear their heart on their sleeves, give everything to their football club. Kevin Keegan was a manager that wore his heart on his sleeve, and everyone saw that as a weakness. We warm up, just me and him. So as we start jogging, he stops and he says, look, I just want to say, I can't thank you enough for letting me have the number 9 shirt. I said, listen, mate, not to worry, it's done. And he went to me, I would have come no matter what number it was anyway. You know what I mean?
Lovely. Your move into the boardroom, you've got your badges, you've got yourself in a position where coaching can be available to you. Why did you choose not to?
Because I didn't think I'd get an opportunity as a manager. That's the honest truth.
This is Upfront with me, Simon Jordan. I believe there are a lot of vacuous, uninformed, unchallenged opinions out there. I want to get to the bottom line and cut through the nonsense. So with this podcast with William Hill, I'm going to get people with strong views who think they can stand them up to proper scrutiny. There's a good chance I might learn something along the way. And more importantly, so might you.
Joining me in today's episode, a striker whose career spanned 2 decades across 10 different clubs. 149 Premier League goals along the way. He was part of the great entertainers from the Kevin Keegan era at Newcastle, whilst he became a cup winner with Tottenham Hotspur, before, more recently, turning his attention from the pitch to the boardroom at Queen's Park Rangers. Les Ferdinand, welcome to Upfront. Nice to see you, Les. Did I imagine this, or did I talk to you, or did we talk to you in 2004 about coming to Palace?
No.
You went to Bolton in 2004, didn't you?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I was under the impression that we'd had a chat with you.
No.
About coming to Palace?
No, not at all.
Okay. It's the stuff of myth.
I would probably have stayed in London if that was the case.
Oh, really?
We
missed out then,
that conversation
we
didn't happen out. At all.
Les, when we have these conversations, one of the first things that we do, of whoever it is, whether it's a footballer or a boxer or a cricketer or a tennis player, is get a little bit of understanding of their journey and how they got to where they got to. Now, yours is born in Acton. Born in the shadow or lived in the shadow of...
Can I just change that?
Not in Acton.
I was never born in Acton. I was born in Ladbroke.
Ladbroke, oh, much nicer. Much more salubrious.
Wasn't back then.
Was it not?
Okay. Wasn't back then.
But born within the shadow of Grenfell Towers, which obviously over the recent years and times has been the subject of a lot of publicity about the conditions of that particular environment. Mm. Was it always football for you? Was it always going to be football? And was football something... Besides, obviously, this family dynasty that we now know about with your cousins and so on and so forth, was it a family background or was it something that you just alighted upon yourself?
It was something I alighted upon myself and probably not believing that I was going to be a professional footballer.
Why?
I was never allowed to go to football. I was allowed to play football, but I was never allowed to go and watch football.
Why?
My parents had an idea of football being a racist environment and a place that would be difficult for me to go and be safe.
So that's the early 70s, yeah?
Yeah, that's for that reason. When my dad came over to this country, obviously he grew up in Ladbroke, and you talk about Grenfell Estate. Mm. That's where I spent majority of my life growing up, on the Grenfell Estate. My dad and his brothers and you know, used to have problems with teddy boys and skinheads and stuff like that. Yeah. So, and I suppose back in the 70s, you know, football was notorious for having skinheads. Mm. So it wasn't an environment where my family thought I would be safe to go to.
So then how does that progress for you?
So how that progresses for me doesn't mean I don't like playing football.
Yeah.
So I'm playing in my school teams. I'm playing, you know, in the playground with my mates. And then, you know, on the estate that I lived on, we formed a little five-a-side team. We probably had the first female manager, a woman called Annie Mills, who used to take us, because we were a group of boys, used to just take us to play football. We enrolled in a league, and we used to just play on a Sunday, on a Friday, five-a-side, and that's where the love of the game sort of like started for me.
But it evolves, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And you then go into non-league football.
Yeah.
Why was the direction for you not an opportunity with a professional club and you go into non-league stuff?
At the time, we was, you know, I was in the same class as Dennis Wise at school.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hopefully you learnt more than Dennis.
I was in the same class as Dennis at school. And Dennis was...
What was he like at school? A bloody pest?
He was a bloody pest, but he was a fantastic footballer.
Yeah.
And he was on the books of Southampton.
You came through non-league.
Mm.
Do you think it gave you a head start in terms of having the mental appreciation to know what the real world looks like rather than the football world.
100%. And I know that for the fact that when I went into Queen's Park Rangers, there were a couple of boys that were perhaps not being given pro contracts that were going, yeah, I'll go and play non-league football and I'll do this job or I'll do that. And I was saying, chaps, you seriously don't know what you're talking about. Mm. You really don't want to do that. You're in an unbelievable position at the moment. Don't throw that away to go and do what I've just come from doing, I'm telling you. And, you know, it took me a little while to adjust to being a professional footballer.
Did it also make you more appreciative of the elite opportunities? Because it feels to me like sometimes I watch Marcus Rashford these days walking around like fucking impending doom is happening to him. And the world is a wonderful place to be a professional footballer. Yeah. It's a huge opportunity. Do you think it made you have a bit more humility? Because it's one of those things that goes hand in glove with you. People talk about you in a way, you know, he's a very genial fellow. He's a very polite fellow. The rumour has it that you're the only fella at Tottenham Hotspur that would pick his kit up and put it in the box rather than leave it for the kit man to pick up. Do you think that was part of what shaped, or was it that personality just there anyway?
I think part of that was just shaped from who I am and what I grew up with my parents, with mum and dad, and it was about having respect for people. That was always the case. But I certainly believe doing what I did and going into what I saw as a privileged situation, being a professional footballer, yeah, you're right, made me a bit more humble, made me a little bit more appreciative of where I was and what I had. You know, it's like anything. If you grow up in an environment where you're privileged,
yeah, that's all you know.
You get used to it. Mm. And there's some of these boys who come through football clubs who come as apprentices and never see the outside world. All they have is that privilege. Yeah. So that's their norm. That's what they know. That's what they understand. So, you know, you speak about Rashford, and yes, you know, I agree, he's walking around like he's got the weight of the world on his shoulders at the moment. I'm not realising that he's causing a load of those problems himself. But that's been his environment since he was the age of 7. And no matter what his family have gone through, that's his reality. Mm. I say to my kids all the time, you know, you ain't gone through what I've had to go through. Your life has been very, very different to mine in the way that you've grown up. But I can't change that because that's what I've done.
It is
for
what
you.
It is, yeah, yeah. Do you look at this generation of footballers and look at the pathway that you came through and look at the opportunities and the world that they live in and think that they don't really get it, that they're getting it a lot easier than possibly your generation did, your brand of player did, and they're getting far too much far too soon?
You know, and I remember having this conversation with Ian Wright, and we were talking, and I said, Wright, how long was it before you became a millionaire? And he spoke about the times at Palace, the goals, the games at Palace.
Previously Dulwich Hamlet into Palace. Yeah.
Then he goes on to Arsenal, and then he has to score 20-odd goals a couple of seasons before he gets that £1 million contract. Mm-hmm. I said, the difference is, you've got kids that are millionaires who've never played in the first team. That's their reality.
Yeah.
You know, so they ain't having to work too hard to get what they've got.
I often think that if you give people too much too soon, it takes away a lot. That's why I think about the characters. We see maybe the game's changed and it doesn't allow for so many characters. But I think that side of things takes away people's ability to overcome adversity.
Yep.
Their preparedness to do things that they don't want to do. And that, for me, I think affects the game and doesn't make it a better place.
That was probably the hardest thing for me as a director of football.
Yeah.
Seeing people not appreciating where they are, what they've got, and how much of it they've got, thinking that this is the norm, and not having to fight and work hard to get what they've got.
That was one of my major bugbears with Ian Wright. We used to be quite good mates, but not so much these days. But I asked him to come and do some striker training at Palace when I was there. Mm. And, you know, get Ian Wright and do some striker training with the players, they're going to fall over themselves, aren't they? And just, Ian, you know, some of them are young kids. Don't drive in a Ferrari. That doesn't help me. In comes the Ferrari, you know. But here we are. Stepping up from non-league to QPR, I mean, how difficult was that?
At the time, I didn't realise how difficult it was. And you go from sort of like buying Match, Shoot magazine, and looking at these, you know, reading these things, and then all of a sudden you're in it.
You're in it.
And then you're in an environment of, I mean, when I the first game, I always remember this. I was going to work my notice at the place I was working at.
Okay.
And there was a game during the week, QPR versus Southampton at Southampton. And I had to ask for the time off so I could go and play in the game.
Right.
Because I honour my contracts.
Obligations, yeah.
Obligations. So yeah. I was like, I was going to work my notice. Most people would have said to the we told him I'm off.
Well, that says a lot about you.
I turn up at Loftus Road. I go, the coach is outside. The first person that walks out to greet me and says welcome and good luck was Sammy Lee. And I've never, ever forgot that. He was the first person that came out, shook my hand, played that first game. And I always remember getting smashed in the game by Jimmy Case. And
of course, yeah.
I mean, you know about Jimmy and
Jim. Of course.
And anyway, he tackles me, and I remember crumpling on the floor, and he says, welcome to professional football, young man. And that was my introduction to QPR.
Joe Francis talked about you, didn't he? And about your abilities and about the fact that he felt that you could be an England player. And you said, I can't even get in the fucking team. How'd you see that one?
Yeah.
Was he? I mean, I knew Joe Francis, obviously, because when I grew up as a Palace fan, and then I watched his career, obviously, as he developed and became a manager under his tutelage at QPR, they did significant things. Yeah. But how important for you was Joe Francis?
You know, people often say to me, you know, who of all the managers you've worked under, who was the best? Gordon, and I think different managers come at different times in your career that help you. Trevor Francis was quite pivotal as well, because
what he did,
he gave me my first opportunity. He gave me my first real opportunity, and I scored against Chelsea.
Right.
I scored two goals against Chelsea, and I thought, I'm on my way here. And then, as you said, Jerry came in. He said to me, look, I've tried to sign you at Bristol on numerous occasions. I tried to sign you, I tried to take you on loan. They wouldn't let me do it. He said, I see you playing for England. And as I said, as you just said there, Spring, I can't even get in this fucking team at the moment. How am I going to play for England? Do you know what I mean? And then he goes, I'm telling you now, you'll play for England. So I said, okay, no problem. And so he was absolutely pivotal in terms of my career at QPR and taking me to a level. And I probably stayed at QPR longer than was probably right for me.
Yeah.
But the reason I did that was because each year I felt I was learning off of Jerry.
Yeah.
And I thought and I always said that the minute I felt I'd stopped learning was the time to move on.
So you're now at a stage, you've been at QPR for 6 years. You said yourself that probably with the benefit of hindsight, you stayed a little bit longer than you should have done. And that's primarily because of your relationship with Jerry Francis. And now you make a move, and you take a move. But before you get this move to Newcastle, I understand you had an opportunity to go to Man United and that Ray Wilkins was kind of blocked that or had something to do with stopping it, which kind of is ironic given he played for Man United. Is there any truth in that?
Yeah, well, what basically happened was I get a call from Razor one Sunday, and he says to me, look, I've been on the phone with Sir Alex and they want to sign you. And he said, look, you've done everything you can do at QPR.
Yeah.
He said, his words to me were, when the best team in the land comes calling, you've got to go.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. He said, look, they've tried to sign you before, and QPR have always said, at the end of the season, at the end of the season, which is too late. So he said, look, what's going to happen tomorrow? You're going to get, the club's going to get a fax. I'll let you know, and then you can speak to the chairman. And that's exactly what happened. The next day, a fax comes in. Speak to the chairman, who was then at the time, Richard Thompson. And he turned around, he said, chairman, I understand you've had an offer from Man United. And he said, how do you know? And I said, well, one of the secretaries at the club have told me. He said, which one? I said, well, I ain't going to tell you.
What were you thinking at this time? You're thinking fucking Man United.
And I think, I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And so anyway, he says to me, okay, do you want to go? And I said, chairman, do you know what I mean? There's not many clubs in the land that would go, right, halfway through the season, I'm going to leave for, but, you know, I mean, this might be an opportunity that never comes around again.
Mm.
So he says, no, I get that. He said, let me speak to Jerry. All right, let me speak to Jerry. He speaks to Jerry, and Jerry says, well, I'm going to resign.
Right.
So anyway, he comes back to me, and he says, look, I've got some bad news. Jerry's going to resign. And he says, and I can't lose my manager and my star centre forward.
In the same week.
So I said, okay, I get that. Anyway, it happened.
That's a difficult one for you, though, isn't it?
You've
got this relationship with Jerry.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, this is the biggest club in English football. This is the club that's now got its engine started, right?
Exactly.
And is winning the Premier League and off it's going.
Yeah.
And Jerry's sort of putting the kibosh on it.
Yeah.
That must have been a bit of a conflict for you.
Now, the truth is, Jerry never said to me, if you go, I'm gonna leave. Yeah. It's what he'd told the chairman.
Right.
So anyway...
So you're not privy to that part?
I'm not privy to that part. Yes. And anyway, Jerry resigns. Chairman calls me up, says, look, there's Jerry's going, blah, 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 blah. What we, you know, basically, we need to do something. And he says, I've got a bit of a plan. I'm going to see if this plan comes to fruition. If it does, might pave the way for you going. So he goes in and he says, I'm thinking about getting Ray back. Mm-hmm. And I think to myself, all right, brilliant. I said, because the supporters loved Ray as a player, mm-hmm. And as a man at QPR. Mm-hmm. So it'd be an ideal shoe-in for Jerry. So anyway, he comes back and he says to me, you know, about a week or look, 10 days later, he comes back. He says, look, I've got some good news and bad news. He says, Ray's agreed to come back. I said, fantastic. The fans
but he don't want you going either.
The fans will love that. He said, but he'll only come back on one condition. Is that you, that we don't sell you. And I'll go, what are you talking about? Because I'm thinking, this is the geezer that's called me and said, you know, you're going. So anyway, Ray comes through the door, knock on his door. So Ray, what's
going on here?
He says, son, I've taught you the most important lesson in life. I said, what's that? He said, you always look after number one first. Never fell out with him.
Right.
Respected the decision. I'm a firm believer. Mm. That's what's meant to be in life will be. I've always lived my life that way. And so,
I mean, that's a nice way to look at it.
That's the only way I could look at it.
Really?
The only way I could look at it. Because otherwise, what you're going to do, you're going to throw your toys out the pram.
Because that's what they do.
Yeah.
That's what footballers do at times. I mean, you must have been a real exceptional individual to have not done that. You've got the biggest club in English football that's kicking ass and taking numbers now.
Yep.
That's alive and thriving.
Yep.
And I should imagine the commercial benefits and economic benefits to you would have been significant as well.
Wasn't thinking about that.
Well.
Okay.
So you move to Newcastle at the end of the season.
Yep.
So Ray gets you for another 4 or 5 months and ultimately then QPR get a decent fee, £6 million, 95, not bad dough, is it?
No.
What was it about Newcastle that attracted you?
Newcastle fans are like Liverpool fans in terms of if you go there and you play well,
they'll love you.
They'll clap your team off the pitch if they feel like you've given their team a good seeing to. Or if you've played well against their team, they'll clap you off. They'll appreciate your football. I didn't know I was going to go to Newcastle, but then when Keegan called up and I had a conversation with him and he told me where they wanted to take the club, what they wanted to do, I felt if there was anyone I was going to learn from and become a better player, it was going to be him.
What was your take on Kevin?
It was a centre-forward's dream. We was all out of attack.
Yeah.
And, you know, when people talk about the tactics, and we didn't. Our tactics were you score two, we'll score three. Mm. You score one, we'll score two. And I think that works, and that worked for us for a long period in the season. But I think to win the Premier League at times, you need to win a game 1-0 and just be
grind it out.
Yeah. And we weren't able to do that. And does that come down to tactical awareness? Probably a little bit of that. But because we'd done so well on the front foot, we just felt we would get back to that and we would do that and we'd do that. But eventually, you know, you come unstuck and that's what happened to us.
This team, this Newcastle team, that everybody, they were almost like everyone's second team, weren't they, because of the brand of football. Yeah. Everyone was willing them on. Bottled it?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Bottom line, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when you take away everything and skin it all back, yeah, that's what we did. You know, that's the bottom line. We bottled it in the end.
Is there any, I mean, I understand that you lose a few games in a row, which then unwinds the psychology. But is there ever a time when a casual response or a blasé response is actually a way to manage a situation rather than panic into it?
Well, we probably felt that. We probably felt that.
Right.
You know, we're losing that. Look, let's not panic. Yeah, all right, we've lost. We know we can play a lot better than that. Let's not panic. And that's probably where we were as a group. You know what I mean, we looked at each other and felt we're good enough as a group of players. And that was probably where we... You know, is there a point where you don't take it too seriously? When I say don't take it too seriously, you don't look into it too much. You just go, right, okay, yeah, I'm right, we've lost that, but let's...
We talk about the casual, blasé nature, potentially with the hindsight. Kevin's wasn't, though, in that interview, was it? That was a rant.
Yeah.
That wasn't someone being blasé, that was someone being affected.
Yes. all supporters want to see players wear their heart on their sleeves, give everything to their football club.
And they can live with the rest, can't they?
Yeah.
Most of the time.
Kevin Keegan was a manager that wore his heart on his sleeve, and everyone saw that as a weakness. Because they felt Alex Ferguson had won the psychological games because he had that rant. Mm. But Kevin was just someone who wore his heart on his sleeve and had to let people know how he felt. And so when we saw it, we actually didn't see it until we got home, played Leeds, and then forget it. And then at the end, you saw the rant by Kevin Keegan. And we went in the next day, and all the boys were saying all the time was, we'd love it if you did this. And no one saw it as a weakness in Kevin at the time. I don't think there was a player in the squad at the time that saw it as a weakness. We just saw it, because we knew Kevin, we just saw it as him wearing his heart on his sleeve. But everybody else started to go, Fergie's won a psychological battle, and just sort of like embedded into us. And we, as you said, at the end of the day, you know, the cold light of day, the word that you used, did we bottle it, was probably the right word. Yeah, we bottled it.
You've just smashed in 29 goals, right? You've got the gravitas of being... You've understood what it was like for Malcolm McDonald, what it was like for Jackie Milburn. You get the dynamics of what it's like to be a Newcastle centre forward. Alan Shearer walks through the door, and you're, here you go, mate, here's my number 9 shirt. How's that work?
Didn't quite go like that.
Well, tell me how it went.
Didn't quite go like that. So basically, we're going on pre-season tour.
Yeah.
We're going to Thailand, to Singapore and Japan, and we're in the airport. Terry McDermott comes running up the escalators after me. She says, Gaffer wants to speak to you. So I come back down the stairs, and Kevin's standing in this little alcove, brings me, standing in the alcove, and he says to me, look, we're going to sign, it looks like we're going to sign Alan Shearer today. World record fee, £15 million, blah, 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 blah. He says, okay. He says, I went, brilliant. He goes, I want you to be the first to know. He said, because what you're going to do is, as soon as we sign him, we're going to hear rumours that you two can't play together and you're going to be leaving Newcastle. He says, I want you to know, I'm not trying to prove anybody wrong. I just believe you two will make a dynamic pairing up front. So whatever you hear, you're not leaving this football club. I said, okay, brilliant. Thanks for letting me know. So I went, walk away, and I said, that's great. What time is it happening? He goes, he'll be joining us on pre-season. I said, okay, brilliant. Go walk away. And he turns around and he says to me, one more thing. I said, what's that? He said, he's asked for the number 9 shirt. And I said, what did you say? And he said, well, I said, look, I'll ask Les. He said, it's a hard thing. He scored 29 goals, so it's a hard thing. But I'll ask him. He said, because I know, he said, but Alan's worn number 9 all his life. I went, so have I.
Yeah, I was about to say.
What is that? All this time, I'm looking at him and I'm thinking, he's talking to me and I'm thinking to myself, I've never stood on the Gallagher end and supported the fellow that's worn the number 9. I've never stood on the Leeds' end and supported the fellow that's worn the number 9. I know Alan's done that.
Mm-hmm.
He's coming home.
But it must have been a part of you just thinking, fuck off.
Yeah, no, yeah, right. Yeah. There was a part of me, but then as I'm going through this with Kevin, I'm thinking about it. And the mere fact that you come and ask me means you want him to wear the number 9 shirt. He went, no. He goes, look. He said, obviously he's asked for a few things. He's asked, can he take penalty? So I've had to ask Peter. I said, you just said I was the first player you've told.
Okay.
Right. So,
you're smart, yes, isn't you?
Right. So we was having this discussion. Yeah. So anyway, I said, listen, mate, you're the manager of this football club.
Yeah, you make the decision.
You've come and asked me this question. It means you want him to have the number 9 shirt. That's what you got to do. I took off and I went to Singapore. So when we land in Singapore, obviously all the players know that Alan's signed, and then all of them are saying to me, "You've given up the number 9 shirt. You've given up the number 9 shirt. Have you sold it to him?" I said no. I can't lie. I didn't actually go through the story that I had with Keegan. And so read the team sheet out, and they go 9 Ferdinand. So I said, Terry McDermott says 9 Ferdinand. Keegan standing said, "You taking the piss?" He says, "What?" "So you taking the piss out of me?" He said, "What are you talking about?" "So you just said Ferdinand 9. So he's gone, "Yeah, I know, but..." And I went, "I'm fucking wearing a number 9 shirt. You've just taken it off me." So Peter Beardsley, and if anyone ever sees the game, I wear the number 8 and Peter wears a number 9. Right? Mm. So anyway, we play the game and stuff, and then Alan flies over the next day, and then Keegan says to me, "I want you to, I wanted to go training with Alan. We played the game and we'd done a warm down in the morning. Alan turns up in the afternoon. He says, "I want you to go and do a training session with Alan." I said, "What are you talking about?" So I've trained. He goes, "I just want you two to get to know each other." I said, "I've just spent a month with him at fucking Euro 96.
Yeah.
I don't even know him any more than I know him. I know Alan. We get on well." So he says, "Okay, no problem." Anyway, Alan comes and we go out and do this little training session. But we warm up, just me and him. We're running around, just a little jog around the pitch to warm up. We're going to do some stretching and some finishing. So as we start jogging, he stops and he says, "Look, I just want to say, I can't thank you enough for letting me have the number 9 shirt." I said, "Listen, mate, not to worry, it's done." And he went to me, and then as we started jogging off, he went, "I would have come no matter what number it was anyway." You know what I mean?
Right, lovely.
Yeah. But you know, that is just football banter. He's like, "I would have come whatever number it was." But like I said, those are the things that went through my head.
Was Shearer a better striker than you?
I think when you look at the sheer amount of goals that Alan scored, you'd have to say he's the top goal scorer in the Premier League. I always remember Kevin Keegan saying to me,
"That's not the question, Liz.
Let me ask you. Let me give it to you another way." So, and that's down to people to judge, right?
But I'm asking you because you know you're a top striker. He was a top striker. He's the Premier League's record goal scorer. He's at Newcastle. He's got your number 9 shirt. Right, he's the world record transfer.
I think what happened at the time, right? The manager said to me before Alan came to Newcastle, he said to me, "You can do everything that Alan can do, but Alan can't do everything that Les Ferdinand can do."
What do you make of that then?
You tell me, that's what he said to me.
Asking you what you make of it.
So when it came to it, he wanted him to have the number 9. So that's where it was. Was I better? His goals would tell you that Noel wasn't a better striker than
him. What do you think?
What did I think at the time? I never thought that I wasn't going to play at Newcastle. When they signed Alan, I never ever thought that I wasn't going to play. Does that answer your question?
Mm. Quote unquote, Les Ferdinand says he's a better striker than Shearer. Were you disappointed? I mean, you've got the gravitas of playing at Newcastle. You love playing for the club. You're scoring goals. Your first season was brilliant. Shearer comes in. We've had the conversation about the number 9. You've taken that acceptance. You've then gone on and scored goals in the following season. But now you're being sold.
Mm-hmm.
Were you disappointed to leave Newcastle?
The fact that I just had a little daughter. And my family were down in London. Spurs were the team I supported as a boy. This gets me back to London, to the team I supported as a boy.
So you talked about it being your worst decision, but you also talked about, from what I can understand, is you met Alan. And I've known Alan Sugar for years and I like Alan.
Yeah.
He's an acquired taste, but he's also a very, very credible operator, right? And you kind of believe what he says when he says it. But what was different about what Alan told you to what you experienced? Because I get the impression, reading between the lines, that it was, not reading between the lines, this is your expression, Tottenham were a club in unbelievable turmoil.
Yeah. And when I say it was the worst decision, I said it was the worst decision for my footballing career.
Right.
The club was, you know, one of the things I say to people, when I got there, we were sponsored by Pony. And that was quite apt.
Okay.
That was quite apt.
Right. But why?
Now, I went to Tottenham, who I would have thought was on a par with Newcastle in terms of the way they did things.
Anyway. Yeah.
And it wasn't. It was so, so different.
In what
way? So, so different. I mean, they'd built their own training ground, a new training ground. And the changing rooms were like going in the Hackney Marshes. And I remember saying to Alan, I said, "You've just built your own training ground. You've built changing rooms like this."
Mm.
You know, I walked into the medical room, and that was probably the only room that was the most comfortable room at the training ground. They had about 6 beds, had TVs on the thing. No wonder everyone's injured at this football club. Got TVs in the medical, it was too comfortable. People reading papers in the it was just everything about it, the training, everything, you know. And Jerry was the manager then.
Mm.
But everything, the organisation. I always remember my first day of training pre-season. I walked out. There was a group of players in one corner doing keepy uppies. There was another group in another corner over there. There was another few players over there in the corner over there. And there used to be a slope, and there was a couple of boys lying on the slope, waiting for the managers to come out. And I thought, what the hell have I come to?
Too easy, Ozier.
For what the hell have I come to? And, you know, I'd been warned. You know, a couple of players had said to me, Les, Tottenham ain't what you think it is. And to be fair, when I spoke to Alan, he knew it wasn't what he wanted it to be.
Right.
And he was trying to change that. And he felt someone like myself coming in and the players might...
But it was his club. Alan had been there for 10 years by that time, hadn't he?
Yeah, but he'd made a load of changes. Right. And he was trying to change it. And
how'd you get on with Sugar?
I always had a lot of respect for Alan. And I thought I got on with him quite well. I spoke quite highly of him. And I said, where Tottenham is today... I felt he put the foundations in place to take it to where it is today. I know he had a load of problems with the late Terry Venables and so on. But I think he put the foundations in place for Tottenham to go to where it is today.
Well, he says what he means, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not, you stand up for it, you know where you stand, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going to skip past after Spurs. Spurs finishes, you've there 6 years. It's not a resounding success for you.
No.
Yeah. By the way, how do you feel about your England career?
I felt at my height. You know, Terry Venables had made a decision that Alan Shearer was going to be his number one choice. Alan went, was it, I think, 19 games without scoring?
Yeah, 2 years, wasn't it?
You know, without and never really getting the opportunity. And again, it was kind of strange because every time I came to play or got an opportunity to play, it almost felt like this was my last chance. And I think, well, hang on a minute, just afford me the same opportunities that you afford someone else.
We're going to go on to now your move into the boardroom and your relationship with QPR. Mm. But just out of curiosity, before I do that, why didn't you decide to continue? You've gone and got your badges, which is a criticism that I have of a lot of players. And we're going to get onto that subject about diversity and representation and the statistics behind that. But you've got your badges. You've got yourself in a position where coaching can be available to you. Why did you choose not to?
Because I didn't think I'd get an opportunity as a manager. That's the honest truth.
All right, well, we'll talk about that in more detail in a bit later on. But let's talk about the decision to go into, because you've got an opportunity now at QPR, and it's a boardroom opportunity. So it's a position of influence and power.
Yeah.
And one of the things that is argued about ethnicity being given the opportunity, you've been given it. Why were you given it?
Simply because I had a conversation with an ethnic minority owner.
With Tony Fernandes?
Yeah.
Yeah. You believe that, do you?
By just by chance. Yeah. I was on holiday in Bali, and at the time my friend, really good friend of mine, Tony, looked after 50 Cent. 50 okay. Cent was singing at Tony's daughter's 21st, or rapping at Tony's 21st daughter's 21st birthday. So my mate called me and we was having a conversation. Tony said to me, "Who are you talking to?" Because he mentioned Les a few times, and he goes, "Oh, Les Ferdinand." He went, "Oh, let me speak to him." So he came on the phone and he said, "Look, we've been trying to bring you back to QPR for a long time." I said, "Well, I'm not the hardest person in the world to get out of town, if you want to speak." Yeah. So we had a conversation. We met up in Jakarta and we had a conversation. He said to me, "Where is it you want to go in football?" And I said, "Look, I've done the applied management course in the LMA applied management course." And I said, "You know, the director of football is something I've looked at for a while and thought there's not enough footballers that do this position. And it's something I've looked at." I said, "I think I'll struggle to get a job as a manager going forward. So maybe this is an avenue to look down."
Well, I mean, what do you think a director of football should be?
For me, the role should all encompass. A manager comes into a football club. Yeah. And if you look at the tenor of a manager.
Should you be appointing the managers?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
You should be part of that process.
Right.
You deal with the finances in terms of, you know, I had a very good CEO in Lee Hughes at
yeah, QPR. I know Lee. Yeah, yeah.
So we worked together in terms of the finances. He told me the numbers that we got to work with. The CFO, Ruben Gandy, used to tell me the numbers that we got to work with. And that's how we had to incorporate what we did. And we would sit down and say, right, we do it this way, this way, this way, this way. You know, the finance director, I'd say, right, these are the numbers. How can we make this sexy enough for this player to come to QPR? Right.
So it's management recruitment, it's recruitment of players, it's disposal of players.
Yep.
It's meeting budgets.
Yep.
Style of play.
Style of play. Yeah, you have to have that in, you know, and when you sit down with the owners.
That'll go hand in hand with the recruitment and the management on it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking for.
Is this all the way down? Is this down in from the first team down into the academy, into the 18s, all the way down?
Because what basically happened is when I went into QPR, We needed to change. One of the things that we spoke about was we could no longer go out and spend money on players in the way that they had been in the past. When I joined QPR, the wage bill was 76 or 78 million.
Yeah, because you come in 14, 15, don't you, halfway through?
Yeah.
And they just got, Neil took them up 13, 14.
Yep.
14, 15, Harry. It's all over the place, isn't it? Yeah. Harry signing people like Christopher Samba on ridiculous money, right? And you come in halfway through, don't you?
Yeah. 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 And so you knew QPR were going to get relegated. You knew they had a budget of 70-odd million a year. And at that time, they probably had one asset in the team. Charlie Austin was the only player when I went into QPR that you could probably look at and think, because of the wages he was on, which wasn't as much as some of the other guys, that you could sell and make a profit on Charlie Austin. The rest of them weren't going to leave the football club because the wages that they were on, the wages that they were on were ridiculously high. They weren't going to earn those money that money anywhere else. So that means you had zero assets at your football club, and now I was being told we need to reduce.
Did you have the experience, Les, to go into that position? Because it's a big departure for you, isn't it?
No, of course not. Of course, I didn't have the experience. Mm. But what the club wanted to do in terms of start developing from the academy, because that's where they needed to go.
Yeah.
I felt like the skill set.
So where were they able to do that? But you've got this. Let's have a look at the record.
Yeah. Right?
As a director of football, QPR get relegated, 14th, 15th, 20th. Right, go down. Statistics will tell you most clubs that come down with parachute payments end up going back up within a 3-year cycle. QPR go 12th, 18th, 16th, 19th, 13th, 9th, 11th, and 20th. So I think that's about an average position of about 14th or 15th in the league, which is nowhere near where you'd expect them to be.
Right.
You're the director of football. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for the recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
You've got some handcuffs on you economically.
Yep.
But notwithstanding that, you know, you do spend some money, not huge amounts.
Right.
You've made appointments, managers. Mm-hmm. How is this successful?
When I went in and Harry left, Chris Ramsey took over as interim manager.
Yeah.
And what happened was, one of the owners asked me, do you think Chris could keep us in the Championship next season? We're not talking about promotion. We're talking about just keeping us in the Championship. The reason being is we got a group of players that we need to get out who are on big money. And because they knew the fine was coming and all that, they needed to reduce the wage bill. So I said, if you're talking about just keeping you in the Championship, I think he's got the capabilities to just keep you in the Championship. Now, where my perhaps naivety was not realising that the amounts of money that the players that were on, that we needed to get rid of was on, that we couldn't get rid of those players. Not only was it the fact that no one was going to buy them, the fact is no one was going to pay their wages. Mm-hmm. So for two seasons, we were just trying to reduce the wage bill because we needed to get down below 20 million.
Mm-hmm.
But some of these players weren't going. And the ones that were going, we had to pay to go.
Pay up, yeah. Yeah.
So in terms of you get the parachute payments and you think that parachute payment you can invest to get you back up again, we can do
that. But that's the same for everyone though, isn't it? It's the same for every club that gets relegated. They all come down with rotten, horrible wage bills that they can't afford.
Yeah, but most of them have got players that can take them back up again and they just add to it.
Right. I mean, I don't want you to be overly controversial just for controversial sake, but you're the director of football inheriting this.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a team that's in the Premier League. How can a team go down with no assets whatsoever that have got no value to the club? What, every club that goes down, you know, Southampton go down, out goes James Ward-Prowse. When I got relegated with Palace, I kept Andy Johnson, but that was the perceived reality was Andy Johnson was going to leave, and he didn't. But most of the time, the top players get sold to be able to bridge the gap.
Yep.
QPR has nothing.
Like I said to you, Charlie Austin was probably the only one at the time that you could probably sell for any amount of money.
With respect to Charlie, all due respect, that's not top end either, is it?
But that's what I'm saying. This is what you had.
Right. So my analysis, in your view, because it is a sweeping analysis, and I expect you to rebut it, because I look at it and go, if I'm looking at this as my director of football, and I'm taking in the unique circumstances at QPR, and I'm trying to put myself in that situation, but over an 8-year period, I've just gone, Les, tell me about this, 12th, 18th, 19th, 16th, 13th, 9th, 11th, 20th. Mm. This is on your watch.
Yes.
And I'm saying that doesn't look like success to me.
No.
Not because I'm trying to be arsehole clever with you. I'm trying to get the flip side of the argument for you to say to me, well, this is the reasons why. And what you're saying is, I'm working in an environment where for several years, we've got no control over our own destiny.
Yep.
Economically, to be able to change the landscape, I can't change the playing squad because the players that are sat there, and I remember some of the names, ain't moving because no one's going to pay a transfer fee for them and no one's going to pick up the wages even if I let them go on a nothing. Yeah.
And they ain't going on a nothing. You have to pay them up.
Yeah.
As you spoke about, a million and a half. So that money, that parachute money that you're talking about, most of it goes on paying these guys up to get to
your owners aren't skint though, are they?
No, I mean, but you could. But because of the financial fair play, they're not allowed to put the money into the club.
Right. But once they've had their sanction.
Yeah, but that you're still governed by the financial fair
still
play.
Got, so you're making £12 million a season. You're still carrying his wages.
Yeah. So you're making sure that Simon, I sit down sometimes and I think, you know what would have been the ideal for QPR to get relegated and get relegated again into League One.
Really?
Yeah. That would have been the ideal because you'd have got rid of those players, and the sanctions in League One are very different to what they are in the Championship.
Yeah.
In terms of being able to build a side and come back stronger, that probably would have been the best. But we were trying to survive in the Championship, and the owners were saying to me, "Les, we just need to survive. We just need to survive." But obviously, in my head, I want QPR to get back to the Premier League,
of course.
And what's the best way to do that? Now, in terms of managers coming through the door. Yes, we had a very democratic system in place.
Well, that's what I'm going to ask you next. How much autonomy did you have in making these appointments?
So what we did was we would sit down and we would myself and Lee Hughes would go out and interview X amount of managers.
Yeah.
And then we whittled down, this is the best five.
Yeah.
And then the owners would come in on the interviews. And then we'd all give an opinion on who we thought was the right one.
Okay. So on that basis, when you were lighted upon, you would have an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
How many times, because we've got them here, we've got Chris Ramsey, we've got Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, just out of curiosity, the first two managers, black managers.
Yep.
Is that your influence? Did you do it on purpose or was it just a circumstance?
Circumstance. So Chris Ramsey takes over as interim manager when Harry leaves.
Yeah.
After Harry left in February.
But they ask you a question, can he keep in the Championship and you vouch for it?
And I said, we're in the Premier League at the time, but the next season they asked, can they keep us in the Championship? And I said, if it's just keep us in the Championship, then he's capable of doing that. I really believed that his coaching requirements would keep us in the Premier League. But then we couldn't get rid of the players that we thought we were going to be able to get rid of.
Right.
So all of a sudden, we've now got this, we've still got this massive wage bill, we've still got these massive players. And then one of the owners comes to me and says, we probably need to try and get promoted. So I turn around and say, well, Chris ain't the man to get you promoted.
No.
So hence Neil Warnock comes in, who they'd had a good relationship with.
Yeah.
Right. But Neil had come in with the proviso that he could only stay for a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
He needed to go on holiday with his wife a couple of times, but he could stay for a period of time. So I said, okay, no problem. What we'll have to do is we'll look around for a new manager. And that's what we did. We interviewed, we went through the same process. And at the time of employing Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, he had the best win ratio of any manager in all the divisions.
At Burton,
he had the best win ratio. But no one looks at that because when I sat down in the press conference to do my press conference, the first question was, are you employing him because he's black? Because I'd done it with Chris Ramsey. And I went, well, no, actually, he's got the best win ratio of any manager.
No, I know. I mean, I like Jimmy. I've met Jimmy on a number of occasions. I think he's very engaging. I think he's a decent bloke. And obviously, I saw his record. I have to ask the question because the question's there to be asked. Yeah. It's not a formulaic response for me. I don't think you employed them because they were black managers. I just wanted to ask you because we've started this conversation because one of your perceptions in life, and I think you still hold it, is about the lack of opportunities because of ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And it leads me into that. What do you believe is the problem in terms of more black coaches getting into positions? Because you said it at the top of this interview, and I understand the experiences of the 70s and your father's influence on your view of the world and racism in football, because it was there.
Yeah.
And it's still racism today.
100%.
Right. We're never going to get rid of racism because there's some pig ignorant people in society.
Yeah.
Given there's a perception, there's a challenge to this, and there's not enough black coaches, what do you think needs to be done to get more black coaches in positions, insofar as something does need to be done?
Just at the moment, there's unequal opportunities for black players and former black players to get into those positions. You know, I speak to a load of players, a load of former players who would like to go back into coaching, just don't get the opportunity. Would like to go into management, just don't get the opportunity, you know, that our counterparts get. And that's simple. You have to care about a situation to make change.
Okay.
you know, a little while ago, there was this talk about the emergence of a Super League.
European Super League, yeah, yeah.
And the noise that was made around that.
Yeah.
Players should, you know, I saw tweets where players should rebel and players shouldn't play. They should pack, you know, blah, 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 blah. And I think, well, this is just because the Super League was mentioned.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking about racism and one thing I talk about is tokenism and people talking about things rather than doing what it takes to solve a problem. I was on the LMA course in applied management when Paul Lynch got the opportunity to go to manage Macclesfield.
Right.
And here's someone that's been England captain Manchester United on occasions, captain all the teams that he's gone and played for, gone abroad and been successful in Italy. Gets his first opportunity at Macclesfield.
Why is that different from Teddy Sheringham getting his first opportunity at Stevenage?
Because I look at all the other people around Paul at that level who've gone into much better positions. When I was at I was at Tottenham and I sat down on a table with a prominent figure in football, and that person said to me, "If you want to be taken seriously as a manager, you need to find a good non-league club with a owner that's got the ambitions of taking this club up into the leagues and blah, 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 blah. And you need to show that you want to be a coach." And I said, I totally accept that. Totally accept it. But why do my counterparts not have to do that? Why they get opportunities in the Premier League and the Championship? They get good opportunities.
Yeah.
But you're saying to me, I have to go to non-league to prove that I want to be a coach. So just doing my coaching badges is not enough to prove that I want to be a manager. Yeah. I have to go to a non-league club. Do you know what he said to me?
Tell me.
We need to change our opinions in the boardroom. You're right. We need to change our opinions in the boardroom.
But that's an interesting one because I can speak from that position. And I'm not going to tell a black man how he should think and view the world, right? Because I'm not black. You know, my nephew is, but that doesn't mean we can all go out and say my friends are black so I can relate to it, right? And that's the old trope, right? But it's not something I relate to. And I tell you why it's not something to relate to, because I was in a boardroom and I would have employed whoever, didn't matter to me. And I'm surprised that someone would say that, because I don't see Egyptian owners employing Egyptians. The argument is you employ what looks like you, right? And what you know and what you're comfortable with. But I don't see Arabs employing Arabs. And I don't see Egyptians employing Egyptians. I see people going for best in class. So
that might be it.
So I'm going to debate with you about this for a second, because I had this conversation with John Barnes.
Yeah.
And, you know, John, this is his life's work at times, right? So you're debating with someone that's very deep in this position. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book that I read because I wanted to have a debate with him. I come from a position of believing that everyone's entitled to an equal opportunity. Not an equal outcome.
No. Nope.
An equal opportunity. So I want to ask you, do you believe in quotas?
I believe in the right person for the right job.
Do you believe in quotas?
I believe in the right person for the right job.
But that's not the same question.
So I'm saying to you, I don't believe I should just be get a job because I'm black.
Right.
If I'm qualified for the job.
And you've got the talent.
And I've got the talent.
You should get an opportunity to get the job.
I feel, should be.
Yeah, absolutely right. What about the Rooney rule?
Don't believe in it.
Why not?
Because it worked
in America, didn't it?
It didn't work in America.
They're saying statistically with the NFL, as a result of the Rooney rule, more and more black coaches manifested themselves into professional American football.
And if you look at it now, it's gone back to what it was before.
Right. Because I can't recognise it, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist, and I'm not suggesting that what I'm saying is right, and I'm debating with you in the same way I debated it with John, right? Because I owned Palace for 10 years, a multi-ethnic football club, in a multi-ethnic environment, with a multi-ethnic supporters base, none of these were relevant to me. Mm-hmm. It was simply just a case of who's the best person for the job, right? Who wants the job? Who can I interview? Who can I talk to? Who can impress me? And the conversation I had with John, because John and I were debating about a raft of things.
I remember it.
Right. And it was a good conversation. And I came away with it with a lot of respect for some of John's points. And I don't believe, Les, this is my belief, and I'm very happy to be corrected by your experiences. Having spent time in most of the boardrooms around the country, with a few exceptions, these guys would employ anybody that's going to win them games. The supporter base doesn't care. Captains of football teams are now black players and have been for some time in positions of authority and influence. And I know that the argument is they can be the performers, they can, but they can't be the impresario.
Yes.
But why is that?
You know,
because it must mean it's racist. It must mean that everything's stacked in a certain way, that racism is prevalent in 92 boardrooms around the country that are going to systematically exclude black talents from being in positions of authority. And it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me.
It doesn't. But, you know, you said that you've been in loads of boardrooms.
Yeah.
Where you believe... Okay, let me give you another example.
Go on.
Okay, so... you've been in loads of boardrooms and loads of directors' boxes.
Yeah.
So when you sit in a director's box, yeah, normally it's not always directors and associate directors that sit in the director's box. You get a lot of directors' friends.
Yeah.
And families.
Yeah.
That sit in the director's box. Very rarely do you see a black person sitting in the director's box, unless he's an agent.
Right.
So that tells me the chairman, the directors, don't have much association with black people. So the association with black people is very, very limited. So I know you're saying to me, if John Barnes had knocked on your door, you would have given him an interview.
Yeah, damn right I would.
I speak to a lot of players that continually put their resumes, their CVs in for opportunities and don't get the opportunity to even interview. And these are black people, these are black former players, these are black players, these are black coaches who've never played.
So by that logic then,
saying to me they're not getting an opportunity.
So what's the blockage then? Why does this blockage exist?
I've got no idea.
Because
I've got no idea. This is what we're trying to understand.
Because the statistics come out, right, and they say 43% of players in the Premier League are black.
Yes.
Right? But we need to distill that properly,
yeah,
because over 50% of those are foreign players that go back to their original countries.
Yeah.
So you've not got 43% of the Premier League being people that live in this country past their playing contracts. Mm-hmm. You're down to 21%.
Right.
But there's only 14% of coaches that are coming through from the statistics I'm told, and mm-hmm. you may know better, that are from the black community. 35% of the clubs in the football pyramid have employed black managers. Mm-hmm. They just happen to be Chris Hughton, or Paul Ince, yeah, or Jimmy at times, you know, because he's had two or three clubs. Saul Campbell's had a couple. So I'm always trying to push back at not resisting the idea, because I'm not stupid, of the notion that there's racism that plays a part in our society. And of course, if it plays a part in our society, it'll play a part in football.
Mm-hmm.
But I do worry that it's used as an excuse. And I'm gonna ask you a very loaded question here now, which you might not like. The rumor is that when the FA chairman's job came up, that you didn't want to go for the job because you didn't think you'd get it.
That's an absolute nonsense.
Is it?
Absolute nonsense. I was never, ever, ever contacted about the chairman's job. I was contacted about the director of football role when Dan Ashworth was leaving to go to Brighton.
Yeah.
I was on that FA talent ID course.
Yep.
Dan Ashworth said to me, Les, you should put in for this director the role I'm leaving. So I said, really? And he said, yeah. He said, we're looking for someone who's done all their pro licence, who's done the job before. And he said, you fit the criteria of exactly what we're looking for. Right. This is Dan Ashworth, who is the director of football and was on the course, was leading the course. Mm-hmm. I went and I interviewed for the director of football job. I didn't get the job. But
But isn't that what you're campaigning for then, isn't it? About equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Because that's what you've got.
Yeah. So, you know, they asked me to interview. I went and interviewed. I didn't get the job. But the talk about the FA director's job, I was never ever been approached by it. I've never even spoken to anyone about it.
Jermaine Defoe recently said, I'm going to ask you what you'd be saying now to young black coaches. Because Jermaine Defoe, he came out and said, I'm not sure if I'm going to bother with this because I don't think I'm going to get an opportunity. And I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear that. Not because it's easy for a white man to say to a black man, I don't want to hear that. But if nothing changes, nothing changes.
Yeah.
And that, what would you say to someone like Jermaine Defoe when he comes out with that?
I know Jermaine well, and I know his frustrations. And the question I would, if you want to be a coach, if you want to go into coaching, that's what you should do.
Yeah.
You know, you should do your coaching badges. But I also know the other side of it, where people have spent the 5-6 years and the money on getting their coaches' qualifications and then not getting an opportunity. But, you know, Simon, I never go on anyone's show, never go on anyone's podcast. I've never been on anyone's TV show, and said to them, look, I'm going to do an interview. You're going to do an interview with me, but I want you to talk about racism. It's always a subject that comes up.
Well, of course it does. But you're also, you're also quite vociferous about it, because it's a very, it's a trigger subject. The media jump all over it because it gets everybody at it.
Exactly.
You know, I want racism out of sport. Mm-hmm. I want prejudice out of sport. I want discrimination out of it. I want people to get a job because they're good enough to get that job, and no one to be excluded.
Or being given an opportunity to do that job.
Given an opportunity.
You know? And you know, you went through my stats there and you said, well, you know, that doesn't seem like success without me being able to explain the reason why we were.
But that's
why
I asked you.
Okay, so yeah. I'm saying, so when I originally got this job, and obviously the comments were, you know, do you feel that you need to be successful for the generations that come after you? You know, you're the first black director of football. Yeah. Well, I wasn't the first, because Michael Imanello at Chelsea was the first. Yeah. But you're the first British black director of football. Do you need to be successful? And I said, it all depends how you deem success. I said, because what you're saying to me, all the directors of football that have gone into every single club have been successful. That's why they get another opportunity. Mm-hmm. So you're saying, if I'm not successful here, if you deem me not to be successful, means I never get another opportunity. Whereas I may have learned a hell of a lot at QPR to take into somewhere else that would be advantageous to that club and myself. But you're saying, because I'm not successful at QPR, I don't get another opportunity. And that's kind of like where this sits. I'm not bringing that conversation up. That's what someone's bringing to me. I know director of football that have moved from club to club to club.
Yeah.
And then they start to have success and everyone talks about them being a great director of football.
See, I wouldn't have framed it that way, though. I think that's a strange mindset to ask you. And I think that's the wrong...
But they're asking
you a question because you're black.
But that's what I'm
that's
saying
bullshit.
To you. So what I'm saying to you, Simon, is those are the kind of questions I get.
Yeah, fair enough.
So then I am looking at it as... This is about my colour.
Yeah.
This is not about me as a director of football. This is about my colour. So as much as you say you don't see colour,
a lot of other people do. So how does it change, Les? I've always got. I think if you take, I would like to see colour taken out of the equation, so that you don't have to make it about colour. You should make it about talent, and that's why I'm always slightly troubled when I see, oh, we want to set up a black PFA.
And
we want to set up black lawyers for footballers. We want to set this, and you're involved in a partnership that does particularly this. By making it about colour, don't you consistently make it about colour?
So I'll tell you what we used to do at QPR. We got to a point where we would look at CVs for a job. And as you said, the person who's qualified and the right person for a job. So we'd advertise for a job, and we'd go, right, we don't want to look at the names on the CV. Don't look at whether it's a woman, whether it's a man, whether it's black, white, whatever it is, we don't know. Because if I said to you, Mr. Ince, Mr. Barnes, Mr. Campbell, Mr. Davis, Mr. You wouldn't know whether they're black or I've used some black names that you know as black players. Yeah. But if I gave you those names on a list, you wouldn't know whether they were black or white. So what we used to do was just look at CVs first and foremost and say, right, you know what, that's what we're looking for. Then we'd look at the name.
Right.
So look, we get this person in to interview. And if they interview, as you said, if they interview and they interview correctly for the job, they get the job. Whether it's male, female, black, white, didn't matter what colour, we looked at the CV. That CV's right for us. This fits our job description. Now we get them an interview. And so, you know, I always used to get asked, you know, QPR are a really diverse football club. You know, one of your leading light, we want to come and do a piece about you. I said, I've employed more Caucasian people than I have black people. Why do you want to do an interview with me?
Mm.
Because we've got a diverse... No, we just employed the right people for the job.
Mm.
But, and you say to... You're saying that black people have the agenda, they want to talk about it. No, I said some. No, yes, yeah, some.
Some
but
people
I'm saying it got put on me more than anything else in my role.
Mm. No, I understand what you're saying. Do you think it will change, Les?
You know, every year I keep saying, I hope it does, I hope it does, I hope it does, I hope it does.
Does it make you optimistic does it make you pessimistic?
Makes me pessimistic. Mm. Because we've been talking about this for so many years now. I was brought into a meeting at the FA at St George's Park when they were talking about this quota in terms of representation at every level.
Yeah.
And I argued that.
Can't be right though, can it?
No, that's what I said.
Yeah, it can't be right.
You have to have people that are qualified for the job. And one of the questions I asked who was gonna analyse whether that person was a good coach? And they said, and at the time in the meeting, they said, well, obviously the manager and the coaches that are already there. I said, well, who analysed them when they came in? I said, because I'll tell you what's going to happen. The minute you go back and you say, this is what we're going to do, we're going to have a quota of black players or black coaches with each section of England, you know, from from the age right down to the 18s or 16s, wherever it is going to be, you're going to have representation at every level. As soon as you do that, you're going to get the eye rollers at St George's Park. We'll go, here we go, we're doing something for them again. And that could be the same person that's gonna critique whether you're a good coach or not. So I never thought it was gonna work, and I don't think it is working. It's just again another token of a visual thing of we've got so many black players playing for the country, but we've got no black coaches, we've got no black staff involved in any of the setup. Now this is not me having a rant. This is just
no. We're
fact.
Talking about it. I'm debating it with you because I'm pushing you. Because I've got certain views, and my views, I like to debate because I'm very happy to be debunked.
Yeah.
And I find those conversations, and people are frightened to have them.
Yeah.
White people are frightened to have them because if they do that, they can be classified as racist.
Yeah.
I'm interested in the debate.
Yeah, no,
because I think out of debate comes educated thinking.
Yeah.
Just because people don't agree doesn't mean you can't walk away from a conversation without people going, you know what? I learned something, or I've got a different view, or I'll stay with the same view.
Yeah.
You haven't got to walk away going, he's a dickhead, and he's this, and he's a racist, and he's whatever. I just like to have a debate about these sort of things. Last one for you. What next for you?
I have to wait and see what opportunities come up. You know, I'd like to have another go.
At what?
You know, at the director of football.
Would you?
Yeah. You know, it obviously became really tough, and it's only now I'm realising how stressed I was. I didn't realise if you care about something and you want something to be successful, you give it your absolute all. And that's what I felt I did at QPR. Some decisions were taken out of my hand, and I understand that because I always say we're advisors and all we can do is give advisors to the owners of the football club.
Yeah.
And if they decide not to take that advice, unfortunately, you roll with it. And, you know, you can say, well, I don't want to be in this anymore, but I wanted to stay there because I wanted QPR to be successful. It didn't turn out that way in the end. But I think I've learned a lot. I've seen a lot, and I think there's a lot I can add to someone going in and doing it again.
Well, good luck.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Listen, Les, enjoyed it very much. Thanks for being so upfront.
Thank you for having me.
Well done, mate.
Cheers.
Upfront with me, Simon Jordan, is brought to you by William Hill. Future episodes can be found on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly.